Well, let's start the last session of the day. I'm pleased to introduce Professor Claudio Michelon. Michelon is Professor of Philosophy of Law at the University of Edinburgh and Director of the Edinburgh Centre of Legal Theory. He has written articles such as The Public Nature of Private Law, The Inference to the Best Legal Explanation, and What Has Private Law Ever Done for Justice? In today's speech, he will tell us about primary and secondary duties. Professor Michelon, your time.
Thank you very much. I'm going to speak standing up because I think better if I stand up. So, which is not a great improvement, so don't get excited. A bit better. So this is, I'm going to try to restrict myself to the allocated time. So if you could tell me about 10 minutes before the end of the time, I'd be very grateful. What I'll do is I'm going to present you with a paper that's going to be published in a book that Sandy is editing as a first part. So I'm going to try to do that in 20 minutes and then in 25 minutes to lay down the groundwork. And then I'm going to move to the questions I have. So it's not so much an argument, but a series of ways in which I'm thinking of structuring what will be the second part of this paper. This paper ends in a bit of a cliffhanger, in which I say, well, you know, that's all well, but a lot of work still needs to be done in this, and so this is how I'm thinking of the work that needs to be done, or part of the work needs to be done. So my worry here concerns the relationship between primary and secondary duty. Just for those of you who are not familiar with the language of primary and remedial duty, I'm thinking about what we'd normally think in civilian systems as the duty that triggers civil liability, so my duty to drive carefully, or a duty that a doctor might have to provide certain information, and so on. And that's a primary duty. And the secondary duty is, or the remedial duty, is the duty that ensues in part from breach of that primary duty. So typically to pay some indemnification, compensation for a loss that was suffered, but not exclusively, but typically indemnification, right? So I'm worried about that relationship. Now, I'm not worried about that relationship in terms of positive law. It's very clear to me and to most people that in most cases of tort liability, the breach of duty is a necessary condition for the breach of the primary duty is a necessary condition for the secondary duty to exist. So in terms of positive law, I'm not that worried about it. What I'm trying to get my head around is the normative relationship between them. So the question I want to ask is, why should it be the case that the breach of the primary duty leads to a secondary duty? The breach of the duty to drive carefully leads to a duty to pay indemnification or compensation. So why that? Why should that be the case? So that's a question that I'm worried about. There are a number of life attempts that are still being discussed about of how to justify that relationship. I'm going to focus particularly in one of them, the so-called identity thesis, and I'm going to talk about another one, which I find superior, the so-called continuity thesis. But then at the end of the day, I'm going to say that the whole debate is in the wrong key, that people have been discussing this as if this was a debate about the metaphysics of duty, and it's not a debate about the metaphysics of duty. So there's a lot of smoke and screens that are hiding the actual problems. And that's why the paper ends in a cliffhanger, because I think that it's time for us to address the actual problem, right? Which are effectively not metaphysical, or even neither metaphysical, not a problem of the metaphysics of normativity, but a problem of normativity, of substantive normativity. Okay, so that's my way of framing. So what's the identity thesis? The identity thesis, which is put forward by Weinrich, but a bunch of other Kantians. The Kantians are the ones that push this particular line. It's quite simple. Actually, it's quite elegant as well. The solution is very elegant. See how the connection the normative connection between the substantive, the primary and secondary duty is no connection at all, because it's the same duty. So the primary duty and the secondary duty are one and the same duty, right? So the identity thesis tells you basically this, that you have effectively a duty to phi or phi prime. So your duty is either to drive carefully, or if you don't and you end up hitting someone, to pay compensation. It's the same duty. So what we have there is one and the same duty. Now that's counterintuitive. I don't know if you find it counterintuitive. I find it very counterintuitive. And I find it counterintuitive because we tend to think of duties as specified by actions, yeah? I have a duty to pay £100, or I have a duty to move a chair, or I have a, duties are specified by the action they demand. And that's very intuitive. I think it's completely intuitive. I think everyone has it, and it's completely wrong. I'm going to try to prove in the next 10 minutes that it's wrong, that that's not, or at least that it's not, the things are more complicated than our intuitions, our metaphysical intuitions allow. I'm going to do that in the next 10 minutes, and my conclusion is not going to be that it's right or wrong, but my conclusion is going to be that this is the wrong conversation to be having. Now, John Gardner is the one who raised this argument, again, the argument of duty specification, in that article, What's Tort Law 4, Part 1. He's the one who said, no, look, you know, we cannot be the same because there are two different actions. If there are two different actions, there are two different duties, so there's not the same. Full stop. Weinberg writes back in 2012. He writes back saying, okay, actually, it's absolutely fine to specify duties in different ways. And in fact, action specification of duty on the basis of the action, is clearly wrong, he says. And he gives two reasons for that. He says it's both over-inclusive and under-inclusive. That there are situations in which, if action specification were correct, there are situations in which there are clearly two duties, but because they require the same action, we'd consider them to be just one duty, and that must be wrong. So think about the example I give in the paper is, suppose that you have a duty that derives from both statute and contract. So you took on a certain duty contractually, and it's also a law also has been passed giving you, assigning to you the same duty, ascribing to you the same duty. So Weinberg says, clearly there are two duties here. One is a duty that comes from legislation, the other comes from contracts. They are different because they have different vicissitudes. You can tell that because one might be subject to the statute of limitations, the other might not be, and so on. So they have different lives, even. So, but if you believe in action specification, you have to say that it's the same action. I have to provide that particular information. So it's the same. So action specification is tempting, philosophically tempting, but Weinberg says wrong, because clearly there are situations in which we know to be, or at least intuitively you would see two or three different duties or four, but they require the same action. Well, not so fast. Let me defend John Gardner here. Yeah, there is a sort of coarse grained, the language that this guy, Peter Vranitz, used, coarse grained action specification that says it's just the action. So duties are differentiated just about the action. But also there are more fine-grained ways to specify it. You can say, well, it's action plus something else. So the action, different actions would be sufficient, but not necessary. So you could actually have, for instance, in this case, it's action plus source. So a duty two duties can be different because they require different actions, or because they have different sources. And that's what Vranitz called fine-grained specification. So yeah, it is about action, but not only about action. There might be other things as well. So it's clearly action is one way to distinguish, but not the only criterion. Perhaps you have a long list of a disjunction, or rather a conjunction, this plus that plus that plus that. And if that's correct, and that seems to be perfectly reasonable, then Weinberg's objection saying, found out why action specification fails, itself fails. An action specification continues to be alive and well. But Weiner has another argument I mentioned, which is the argument that says, well, but there are sometimes different ways to perform, to fulfill the same duty. Yeah? So you can pay your rent by, well, not in all contracts, but in some contracts when it's not specified, it could be by giving cash to your landlord, or by writing a check, or by making a bank transfer. So those are different actions, yeah? But it seems to be the same duty, the duty to pay rent. So why not just, action specification must be wrong. It must be wrong because if for each duty there is one action, then in this particular case the duty corresponds to a number of actions. In fact, you can continue to break it down by paying cash in 5 notes or in 10 notes or in coins. Or again, there are probably not infinite, but countless ways in which you can further specify the action. I'm not impressed by that argument, in part because the question is that he's assuming that those descriptions of the action are mutually exclusive. That either it's about giving you 5 banknotes, or I paid something. No, I can paying something is perfectly something can be at the same time an act of payment and an act of giving 5 notes or an act of making a bank transfer. So I don't see why I should disbelieve action specification. So, okay, your intuitions seem to be now in the right track, right? Because my intuition, your intuition, was that action specification was the best way metaphysically to specify duties, and then the identity thesis that says that they are the same but they are different actions is wrong. Okay, but that is turned. I think that so far so good, but Weinberg can use the same strategy that I use to help Gardner to help himself. He can say, yeah. So you're telling me that it's not only about action. It could be action plus something. Well, that could be just a plus something, yeah? It could be something else that the duty share that's not the action, but it's share between them that make them the same duty. So although the actions are different, they are the same under a particular description. There's a certain description that makes them exactly the same, in spite of being 2 actions. And he has an explanation for that. He says it's the ground. They have the same moral ground. They are both the fulfillment of the same right. There are different ways to fulfill the right. Yeah. So I can fulfill the right by either, for instance, driving carefully, or by paying you indemnification for not having driven carefully and hit your car. Now, I think that that's a bit dodgy, myself, because it seems to eliminate the... it seems to make the primary and secondary duty completely interchangeable. So it's not that you have an obligation, firstly, to drive the car carefully and then pay compensation. It seems to be, it's a disjunction, either do this or that. I find it a bit dodgy, but I'm not going to get into that. Because my worry here is not that. My worry here is to show that there's some plausibility to Weinrib's idea. Now, if John Gardner's idea of action specification is not vulnerable to Weinrib's criticism, and if Weinrib's idea of ground specification, let's call it, specification of duties because of the ground they have, the same ground, is not completely out of bounds either, so both of them are in play. But that's why I think we have to start asking a different question. Now, I think that there are very good reasons, perhaps not conclusive reasons, but good reasons to prefer some sort of action specification at the metaphysical level. Some sort of fine-grained, probably, possibly coarse-grained even. I'm not going to get into that because, as I told you, my plan is to do it in 20 minutes, so I'm not going to get into that. I think there are good reasons, in particular to do with theoretical gains like consilience and economy of theoretical economy and so on, but I'm not going to get into that. My point is this. Let's suppose that what this intuition that I have about action specification being right, coarse-grained action specification being right, let's suppose it's on the money, that actually I'm right, and coarse-grained specification purely by action is the way to identify duties, like Peter Vranes seems to think it is. Let's suppose that I'm right. Would that appease wine grape, orchard garden? Would they feel, oh, yes, yes. The metaphysics of Chichi says that. So clearly my whole theory about the relationship between primary and secondary duties has collapsed. I don't think they would. And I don't think they would because for them, in spite of the fact that they use explicit metaphysical vocabulary, Weiner talks about Aristotelian metaphysics, literally, when he tries to put forward his arguments. John is clearly relying on metaphysical intuitions we have about how to specify duties in general. In spite of that, I don't think that's actually where the argument can be settled. I think this is a normative argument. But for us to see that, and I think it's a normative argument, and I think the debate between the identity thesis and what we're going to see now, the continuity thesis, that debate is a debate not so much about the totality of the problem, it's a debate of how best to frame the problem before we start fencing normative arguments, how to frame the problem. So it's still useful to know the difference, and I think the continuity thesis is better than the identity thesis, but just as a way to frame the problem. And I'm going to try to prove that in the next 8 minutes. Right. So far, so good. Okay. So, just to recap, what Weinreb is telling us is that it's the same. Primary and secondary duty are the same. Therefore, what I have is a disjunctive duty. Yeah. Either do this or that. Either drive carefully or pay compensation in case you drive directly. You drive recklessly and hit someone, etc., and all these other conditions for liability. It's a disjunction. And where does he ground that? He grounds that on the fact that they have the same they have the same ground. What's the ground? For him, and that's a substantive Kantian thesis, for him it is the duty I have not to interfere with your freedom, right? I'm simplifying it massively here, but you get the point, yeah? So you have a sphere of legal, of moral positions, you have some entitlements to the pen you're holding and to, and you have those moral positions, not only legal positions, but moral positions, and you have an entitlement, and I have a duty, that I don't interfere with that without a good reason, but let's leave that aside for a moment. So there's this idea of an interference with someone else's sphere of rights, if you like, or sphere of legal positions. That's not authorized by the person. And in fact, if you look at some 19th century German benedictistic books, that's the definition they give to illicitude, is the non-authorized intervention of the sphere of rights, in this case, legal rights, that someone else has. So if I subtract the right from your sphere of rights, that's an illicitude. And not all illicitudes, as you know, lead to indemnification, yeah? But there are other conditions as well. Anyway, so that's a parenthesis. So far, so good? Okay. But that seems to be quite narrow, because what we have here is a situation in which the only ground to force someone to pay indemnification, or for you voluntarily to be morally justified in paying indemnification, is this one thing, which is the interference with someone else's liberty. But on the face of it, there seem to be multiple other, sorry, I'm getting out of the frame, sorry about that. Yeah, because normally at this stage, I'd be already down there and somewhere in the back, walking around the building. It's a disembodied voice speaking from someone. Weinreb is telling us that there are other, intuitively, there are very many other reasons. Suppose that, for instance, you hit, you drive slightly negligently and you hit a Ferrari of one of the Russian magnates and now you have to pay 100,000 euros to fix the Ferrari. But let's suppose that you're not rich and you're actually quite, you're not very well off, and that's going to push you below a certain line of poverty with immense suffering for your family. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't pay, but at least you have to acknowledge that that's a good reason not to pay, And it might even be a good reason not to have a moral duty to pay, and certainly a very good reason not to have the law enforcing you to pay this 100,000 pounds, effectively living in slavery for the rest of your life. Yeah, and the law doesn't. Yeah, there are some limits to what you can collect from people. There are rules about insolvency and so on. So clearly, those are three different things. There are reasons for you not to pay. There are reasons to think that you might not have a duty to pay, even if you wanted to pay. And there are further reasons to believe that the law shouldn't force you to pay, even if you had a moral duty and if you wanted to pay, right? So this seems to be intuitive, that then there are other reasons that bear on the existence of the secondary duty, or on the shape, perhaps, of the secondary duty. But for Weinrib, there cannot be. Because remember, it's the same ground. It's either this or that. It's the same duty. So no other consideration should come into play if you accept that the primary duty actually existed. So I might deny that there is a primary duty to drive carefully anyway, but if you don't deny that, if you accept that there was that, there's no normative space, logical space for you to include more considerations in the transition between primary and secondary duty. And that seems to be counterintuitive. Yeah. Okay. What's the alternative? Well, one alternative is provided by John Gardner in his continuity thesis. It's a funny thing with John, because if you read an early article by him in the Review of Metaphysics, I think, he seems to actually think that he believes in the identity thesis, right? He actually says, he states it literally. Avant la lettre, because Weinrib himself wouldn't have actually formulated that in those terms before later on. But then later on, John has a change of heart because of his metaphysical conception of duty. And then what he says is this: there's clearly a connection between primary and secondary duty. But that connection has to do with this underlying reasons. So there are reasons that ground the existence of the primary duty and the right that comes with the primary duty. Those reasons, they don't simply die when you violate the duty. Yeah? So they continue to bind you somehow. So what you do now is a sort of second best. You're trying to do the second best, but notice, now you have a lot of space for other reasons to play a role, because it's not talking necessarily in terms of duties. If you remember from your legal theory, duties, they are reasons for action, but they are reasons of a particular kind. They are reasons that exclude other reasons, yeah? At least one subset of other reasons, non-empty subset of other reasons. So for Weinrib, everything else is excluded. For John, things might or might not be excluded, but he's not committed to excluding anything. The continuity thesis doesn't commit you to justify any exclusion. And that's why, and that's when I finish the exposition for this paper, and that's why I think that the continuity thesis is superior as a way to frame the debate to the identity thesis. Because everything you get from the identity thesis, the ability to talk about the continuity between reasons, because duties are reasons after all, you have also in the continuity thesis, but what you don't have is the baggage. You don't have now the need to justify also the exclusion of a number of reasons. It might be that all the other reasons you have are going to have to meet in the common play of weight. It might be that you have reasons for some, and I think you're right on that, Sanjay, that when you start moving like Weinrib to that level of abstraction, suddenly, really, it becomes an illuminating, because what you want to see is how particular duties, primary duties, and particular secondary duties relate. If you're talking about some abstract idea of freedom, it just becomes an illuminating. But what, if John is right, that interplay of reasons can happen at a much lower level of abstraction. We look at reasons why doctors have duties and in relation to patients to inform them. We see that they violate that duty, and we see that the doctor is still bound somehow to try to minimize the damage that he or she caused by not giving the information, paying for remedial treatments from the damage that he caused, psychological damage, and so on. So we can see still that there is a connection between the primary and this potential connection between primary and secondary duty on the basis of the underlying reasons. But you're not committed to a very rosy conception of what the underlying reason is. A duty to, very abstract, a duty to respect people's freedom as deposited in objects sometimes. So far, so good. This is when people normally get lost when I talk about this. But, okay, so I think that what the continuity thesis gives us is all the benefits of the identity thesis without the burdens. And that has implications, because I think it's much more difficult for you to justify a general duty you have to respect someone else's freedom that corresponds to the exclusion of any other non-individual freedom considerations consideration that might bear on the particular. Okay, so John Gardner also mentions that sometimes courts think about the state they're going to leave the legal system when they create a precedent. Yeah, they think, okay, if I decide this now, this is going to be a mess. But also, McCormick has a good example, which I find interesting, about the ice cream. If I promise my kids to buy them ice cream over the weekend, I fail to do it. Now I have a good reason to do something else, to give them ice cream some other day, to do something else that might respond to the same reasons that in the first place created in them the moral right to demand from me the ice cream on the weekend. But it's hardly a judicial matter, isn't it? There are very many good reasons why a court would say, no, come on, let's not really enforce this particular violation of a duty here. Because let's say that there's no primary duty, legal duty, anyway. So all those things can be accommodated, I think, with the continuity thesis framework. And many of them cannot be accommodated if you have the dependence, the identity thesis framework. What I meant to call this talk, though, was what do Kantians want and what do they need? Because it seems to me that we have to have clarity about what they're, why they're doing that, why they're creating such a demanding conception of the connection between primary and secondary duty. Why are they doing that? And second, if they are doing that, depending on why they're doing that, what do they need to actually deliver on creating this sort of insulation? So I think there are three basic ways to think of what they have in mind. And this is the experimental bit of the paper, right? There are three basic ways in which I conceive what the project is. The first one is a project about trying to rule out the use of certain reasons from the law of torts altogether. Reasons such as welfare maximization, for instance, or welfareist reasons. And in fact, Weinrib seems, the first beef he had was against law and economics and all those people who were trying to reframe the whole of tort law as a way to maximize certain welfareism, yeah? Welfare maximization. But as John and others said, yeah, that's a terrible primary reason. So welfareism is a bad way to think of tort law anyway. So it's not that we need to create a mechanism to exclude it by kind or type. It's just, those are just bad reasons, right? So perhaps we shouldn't exclude them. We should actually show that they are just bad reasons, rather than saying that they are not the kind of reason we can even consider, like the identities of heavens. If that's all they want, I don't think it's a very worthwhile project, because welfareism is just a bad way to think of reasons. But it could be more. Perhaps they want to exclude a certain class, more general class of reasons. They want to exclude, say, all consequentialist reasons of all kinds. Then again, I would have certain problems, because there are some intuitively very sound consequentialist reasons that courts often use, like the one I just mentioned, not leaving the legal system in disarray and so on. But again, that could be another objective. And the final objective I forgot, and then I wrote it down, that's why I wrote it down. Final possible objective is to provide some, and yeah, that is, I think, probably the most charitable way to think, is to provide, is that they, all they want to do is to create in lab conditions, to create a system that allows us to see all the implications of violations to freedom. But they're not denying the rest, they're just saying, sometimes for us to actually know how a chemical process works, we have to isolate everything else and do the experiments, and then we get the experiment. But we know that in the real world, other things, we don't find those substances in that level of purity, but perhaps they are doing the same. Perhaps they are saying, look, what all we are trying to do here is to isolate this idea of violence to your autonomy and just work it out to the end, what would follow, but of course in the real world conditions. Now, I think that's okay. The question I would ask is, it's clearly not what they actually have in mind, because Weinrib and Ripsim, they're constantly commenting on positive law, saying that they're wrong because they're not sufficiently Kantian. But regardless, a Weinribian or a Kantian could think that, yeah? And then the question is, so what? Okay, you can have some clarity about what your freedom requires, but clearly that doesn't explain the relationship between primary and secondary duty. At best, it explains a small aspect of that relationship, but certainly not the integrality of the relationship. Okay, so what I think they want to do is to actually exclude everything from the decision-making, from the structure of the law, everything else but considerations that have to do with individual freedom that's been vulnerated by some action. So what do they need to do that? They can do it if they discharge a number of burdens, alternative burdens. So one thing they can do is to bite the bullet and say, well, it's just really lab conditions. And so it's a very humble claim. I don't think they want to do that. But more importantly, and probably what they would do, is to say that there is an indexical order, a systematic priority over considerations of the value to the individual sphere of rights over any other moral consideration. And that's a very well-known Kantian strategy. If you remember your John Rawls, you'd remember the indexical order between the first principle of justice and the second principle of justice, between the principles of justice and normative consequentialist considerations. So Kantians are very good at telling you that there are different types of considerations that shouldn't communicate, that some types of considerations win the battle without having to look at the weight of the relative considerations, that they are systematically prior or indexically prior, to use Rawls's term, to they appear in indexical order, to use Rawls's term. And that seems to be what the stakes are about here. So what Kantianism is trying to tell us is that the appearance of there being a plurality of different moral considerations that we all probably see. You see different sorts of moral considerations being used in public debate, in your debates in the bar, when you talk to your friends, and some of them are concerned with freedom. Others are concerned with generating certain instrumental benefits, maximizing the wealth of a particular group, redistribution wealth, and so on. So some of them, they have to do with things that are not reducible to a Kantian conception of freedom. And if they are not reducible, what Weinrib is telling you is that either they are not moral considerations at all, or they are moral considerations of an inferior kind. And regardless of the particular situation, moral considerations based on freedom, individual freedom, always prevail. In fact, after I published this in SSRN, before Sadi's book came out, I asked, and I put it in SSRN, Weinrib has been in touch. I don't know him. He just sent me an email a couple of weeks back. And he said, yeah, that's exactly right. I think that those other considerations, they don't register. They are not, either they are. So if you cannot translate that into individual freedom type consideration, rights type consideration, they don't register as moral considerations. They might be instrumental or prudential considerations, but they don't register. Now, I think that he was being a bit disingenuous because he has a way to try to accommodate things, and that's the last thing I want to tell you today about. He can try to accommodate things, and he did, with this idea that he got from Kant of a system of rights. Right? So the idea is this. Some of the considerations that you think are instrumental considerations, or that you think are prudential considerations. Some of those considerations that I'm telling you that we see as plural considerations coming from different sources of value, some of those can be retranslated into a system of rights. So you might think that your individual freedom should be framed against the background of the freedom of others as well, and then you can restrict a bit what you think that would be the original freedom in a situation of state of nature before you have a community. So what he says, a number of different texts, Weinrib and Ripstein mentions that as well, is that, yeah, of course, there are some limitations to your personal freedom come from the fact that other people have freedoms as well. And they got to the point in, there's an article he wrote called The Duty to Charity. The Duty to Charity, in which he even says that some redistribution of wealth could be justified from a Kantian perspective. So clearly some of those, one strategy they could use is to try to retranslate some things that look to us like considerations that have to do with not freedom, but other aspects of your well-being, with the fact that you have enough food in your plate and so on, into freedom considerations. And they do that sometimes. They retranslate that into freedom considerations. What I think is that that's not sufficient, because still there is a bunch of reasons that cannot be easily translated into individual freedom considerations. And in fact, that's what Weinrib confirmed. The example I use in the paper, the person who would fall below the poverty line with dire consequences to their family, what he says literally is, yeah, that's just, that doesn't prevail over the individual freedom of the owner of the Ferrari. What can I say? Not Ferrari, because I didn't say it was a Ferrari, but the individual freedom of the person who had their rights violated. And I don't think that's still plausible. So even if you try to accommodate some of those reasons as part of a system of rights rather than simply the relationship between you and your property, say, or your body, I still think the remainder is of such significance that it's in itself a good reason not to adopt the identity thesis.
Professor, now, 10 minutes left.
A bit further, sorry. 10 minutes ago. No, I'm actually good, because I'm going to finish in about 3 minutes. So thanks. So the worry is what's now, right? So what I'm thinking of doing now is to write about this, about the normative aspects of this Kantianism. Weinrib is publishing a new book soon, and he has a couple of chapters specifically about that, and he was gracious enough to send it to me. But my idea is to try to now look at the problem from a normative point. So now I think the question of metaphysics of duty, I hope I laid it to rest. Right? As often happens in legal theory, we never do, because someone else is going to say, it's okay. But I hope to have laid it to rest, as we always hope. I think the question of framing, I think I'm right as well, the question of framing shows great advantages to the continuity thesis over the identity thesis. But now the real work starts, yeah? Because it might turn out that Weinrib is right. It might turn out that all our intuitions about there being plural values, they cannot be vindicated, and there is only one value, and whatever can be reduced to that one value. And that private law has to be structured around that one value. I think that that's neither explanatory nor normatively of private law as it is, nor normatively sound. But I haven't shown it yet, and that's the next step. So I'm very keen on any comments or criticism or ideas that I might nick from you. And I promise to give you full credit in footnotes after I explain your ideas. But anything that can help me understand better grasp this idea of how the relationship is not only structured, but on the substance of the relationship between primary and secondary duty. Thank you.